Hey folks, welcome to the E-Commerce Playbook Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Gaffin, Director of Digital Product Strategy here at Common Thread Collective. And it's a brand new year for us here at the E-Commerce Playbook Podcast 2024. And so what we're going to be digging into today are some predictions for this new year. And I want to say one thing before we get into it. One resolution that I have is to do the intro a little bit different every time rather than doing the exact same thing. So instead of introing Taylor off the bat, I'm going to ask instead Taylor, who is with us, what are your resolutions for this year?
Ooh, so I've been trying to do this with my kids. Like we sit down together and I found like a very basic template that we all work through that involves four categories. I'm going to put this up on the screen. So it's like work, health, personal, and travel. And so we all sit down together and you have to come up with two in each category. So I went through and did some of those. So I turned 40 this year. That's a big deal. And so I'm having this party. I'm calling it the Taylor's Eras party.
Nice.
So to play on that. But the idea is I'm going to invite everybody I've ever met in my life to come to a birthday party with the premise that the only time you would ever gather all the people through the course of your life, you know what it is? Your funeral. That's the only time. So my wife and I, so one of my big resolutions is to plan this party where it's basically an open invite to, if you know me, you show up and there's name tags for the decade that you knew me from. So from the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, or the 2020s. And you throw the name tag on and we see each other probably one more time before you show up to my funeral. So that's one of my big resolutions.
Wow. There you go. Getting at midlife, getting prepped for the end. There's probably something philosophically valuable in that, I would say.
That's right.
Cool, man. All right. Well, speaking of New Year's resolutions then. We're not necessarily doing New Year's resolutions for e-com for this year, but what we are going to be talking about here is Taylor has some predictions for what's going to be happening here in 2024, some trends, some things that we should be aware of. And if you want to think about it in terms of resolutions, there are resolutions perhaps you can make around these five things and how to predict them and sort of stay ahead of them. So I got a list here. I'm going to read them off one by one and we're going to talk about them, Taylor, and you're going to tell us what we can expect here in this upcoming new year. So number one on this list that I have before me is the rise of the product influencer brands. Now, what does this mean? What is a product influencer, Taylor?
Okay, so the obvious trend is influencer brands, but I actually think there's a huge flaw in this model, which is that one of my underlying trends that I think is the key to all of this is that product is really the magic, that the actual thing you're selling matters immensely in terms of the capacity for a brand to be awesome. And there's this trend right now. So I'm going to use an example. There's a guy by the name of Johns Paul's Balls. Do you know who this guy is?
No, I don't.
Okay. So go on TikTok and search John Paul, J-O-N, Paul's Balls. Okay. And this guy is a craftsman that started taking old material and sewing them into really cool soccer balls. Okay.
Interesting.
And he made these amazing TikToks about it. Right. And they blew up. And it's like really rad. Like the things that he makes are like art. They're beautiful. And if you think about a category like sports balls, like if there's any room for there to be some excitement and innovation, like if you picture a basketball or your football or baseball in your mind, we all see exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. There's very little change in the structure of it. But this guy started this and he would sell them one off as art pieces. Okay. But very recently he announced that he's launching a brand, called 12 Pentagons, okay? And he's going to make larger batches of these custom designed soccer balls. And this is reminiscent of, we used to own a brand called FC Goods. And FC Goods began with a guy by the name of John Brong, who was similarly a craftsman creator that in his free time just started making wallets. And I think that at the origin of most great brand story, like if you go back to the beginning of Coach or the beginning of Louis Vuitton, is that. A craftsman making something special. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're going to see is that these creators now are actually going to have a capacity to build audience that's going to give them the thing that they need to distribute their wares and goods. So I think this idea that it's not going to be the influencer that's famous for doing TikTok dances or get ready with me's that launches a makeup line, blah, 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 blah. Like, no. We're going to see the authenticity of the quality of the good being driven by these creators as a trend that comes forward. And Johns Paul's Balls is a good example.
Okay, interesting. So the idea here that being like the person begins as a product creator of some kind, then through that creation becomes an influencer just sort of based on the merits of the product itself in some ways. And then that's that right. becomes the thing. So sort of
yeah, they are famous for the product more than they get famous and then release a product.
And then release a product afterwards. Okay. I like it. So this is sort of Chip and Joanna Gaines before TikTok
there you go.
Or something
sure.
like those lines. Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. Okay. So this sounds like this next piece of the puzzle might be sort of related to the first. So
yeah.
prediction number two is the less better stuff trend. So that sounds
yeah.
self-explanatory, but maybe unpack that a little bit.
So I think the world moves in these sort of like waves, I think, of sort of an onslaught of one trend followed by a sort of very strong resistance to it. And so I think we're coming out of the Shein and Temu era, mm-hmm. right? And I'll even put Amazon in there too. I don't know about you, but my home is cluttered with cardboard boxes.
Yeah.
Like to the point that like, some of the stuff I can't even like, I have so little attachment to, and it matters so little to me that it just becomes this total commodity that I begin to almost disdain.
Yeah.
Like the stuff you begin to disdain, you're like, why do I have all this crap? And it doesn't matter. And you watch your kids sort of toss it aside and there's no connection to it. It doesn't last and it feels so wasteful. Mm. And I think that if you begin to see the narrative around Temu and these things is that it's crap,
yeah.
that we don't want crap. And I think that in that becomes this underlying current where someone like John's Paul's Balls, or even in e-commerce, you're seeing this a lot of, we're sort of coming out of this era where it was just so much stuff with labels on it ordered from Alibaba that got distributed in all these ways that I think that there's going to be this like deep appreciation for substance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try and resist the word authenticity because I think it's like a little bit of a quagmire, but I think this is really about the actual quality of the good itself. And that there's going to be, you know, there's these recessionary undercurrents. And so the thoughtfulness of our purchases tends to matter in those moments. And I think that there's going to be a rise in these, like this craftsmanship consideration.
Mm-hmm.
In this
moment. So in other words, that the amount of customer demand for quality is going to reach a breaking point of some kind where it actually makes an impact on, because one thing that, you know, I was going to say is that there's a certain narrative that the free market tends towards creating crap for more money just because it's cheaper. But you're saying that there's going to be enough of a pushback against the sort of, because I too have a meat thermometer that broke after 10 days, you know, that kind of thing.
That's right. That's right.
Enough of a pushback that just quality buy for life type of stuff is going to become more to the forefront or become more.
I think that what happens is like a TikTok Shops is another, I think, driver of this, where I think TikTok Shops is such a powerful mechanism that what it's going to do is create a really shitty product experience for a lot of people.
Hmm. Interesting.
And what happens when you buy something crappy? Like you start to go like, well, that wasn't a good use of my money. To your point, the meat thermometer that broke, or I've gotten on TikTok Shops. It's really powerful. And this is why I think what causes this trend is I bought this thing that looked like in the photo, a rug for my kid's room. It was this glow in the dark astronaut, and it came, and this thing was it was way smaller than the photo made it seem. And it was crap, dude. Mm-hmm. It was crap. And so I felt stupid. And the feeling it created for me was not a good one. And I didn't feel like I was caring for them. Like it was honestly like, would I really give this to them?
Yeah.
Like that's how it felt. And so I think that experience is going to happen a lot. You buy things off of Temu, Shein, maybe not Shein, it's a little more fashion. I think there's probably a little bit better quality of experience in some ways there. But TikTok Shops is a trash machine. It is literally a gigantic trash machine. And I think there's going to be resistance to that at some point.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it reminds me of the old maxim of that nothing kills a bad product faster than great advertising. And maybe a way you could paraphrase
that
is nothing
kills.
That's
a great way to call it.
Nothing kills a bad product better than or faster than a great advertising platform, which is maybe kind of what's happened with TikTok Shops. Interesting. Okay.
I also think there's like the other thing I've seen on TikTok Shops is like I posted about this the other day is knockoffs are crazy. Like, so there's this like giant trend around Carhartt jackets for $19. And dude, there must be 1,000 affiliates running this offer for whatever dropshipper is shipping these knockoff Carhartt jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that would do if I'm Carhartt is that drives me to sort of in resistance to this fake, not real thing, find some way to elevate the real thing.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's this like, it's sort of this idea too, where the counterfeit market actually drives the demand for the premium market too.
Mm, interesting.
What, you know? And so I think that is part of it as well, that the existence of TikTok Shops is going to drive Carhartt to figure out how to help people differentiate the real thing and elevate the demand for those that can actually get to that piece.
Interesting. So this is a little tangential, but there's a sort of similar trend that I've seen recently too, with Google and information on Google as well, where like the quality of like a Google result, like organically, like if you ask a question, like for instance, what's the best meat thermometer I could get? It's just, you know, one after another of just SEO bait articles. Awesome. But if you type in what's the best meat thermometer I should get Reddit, it takes you to Reddit and you can hear real people telling you about it. And that's how people are starting to get their information more and more and more and more. And so it's this sort of like acts of resistance against the algorithm just sort of dishing you out cheaper and cheaper things. I think it's maybe something that's starting to happen. But
yeah, and it's funny. I don't know if you saw, did you see the post that Aaron did where he actually got, so Aaron Orendorf used to work at CBC, SEO guru, and one of his favorite party tricks is to like take a phrase like most handsome man in Oregon, SEO resist result himself, where he had taken all this time to make the cutest baby in the world or something, Cody Plofker's child.
Right.
And not only did he get that as the snippet when you search like cutest baby in the world or whatever, but now when you actually go into Bard, like Google's AI, and you ask the AI who the cutest baby in the world is, it says like, well, you can't be for sure, but some people say it's, so like Aaron is informing the AI in this way that you start to realize like, holy crap, like it's sort of this search for truth. It's search for meaning. And I think product connects probably to this trend. You know, there's a lot of people that think like religion is going to make this sort of like emphatic comeback because people are like in search of meaning. And I think product, like we sort of project that pursuit onto it. And when we discover fake, it feels bad inside of us. Like we're like, oh, I failed at the process of discovering something real. And I don't think that's a very good feeling for people.
Yeah, no, it's not. All right. I like it. The pushback against fake is another 2024 bonus prediction. Okay. Speaking of which, perhaps number three, this is one that's most interesting to me. I think the TV grift comes to an end. Oh, right. What does this mean?
So I think this is kind of funny, right? Because TV, like, wait, wasn't that a while ago?
Yeah.
Dude, there's this thing that happens in our space all the time where some channel bubbles up as a trendy idea of alternative opportunity for scale and incremental volume. Mm-hmm. It was TikTok last year. Mm-hmm. Everybody was like, this is the place. This is where you should move your dollars. It was Pinterest 3 years ago. It was Snapchat before that. And it's driven by really powerful, highly incentivized, usually some sort of tech platform layer and sales organization that drives it. And right now there's a lot of these in the linear TV realm, these platforms that are demand provider, DSP providers of ad inventory of television, both linear and cable TV. And they make the process of buying media really simple, which is always sort of this catch-22 a little bit between the sort of barrier to entry and the efficacy of the thing in some ways. But what I've seen is that it just became, everyone so desperately wants there to be some additional place that what happens is the possibility of it and the ambiguity of the results create a space that is easy to occupy with anecdote and easy to occupy with aggressive sales tactics and opportunity and sort of cloudy results in a way that I think has been really detrimental to a lot of brands that I've seen. I have seen a lot of wasted dollars in this space, but here's the problem. Dollars can't be wasted anymore. Mm-hmm. And when dollars can't be wasted anymore, there's an obligation to efficacy, and you are going to see less dollars be spent in places where they don't work. This is programmatic. This is TV. These places that are housed by less than effective ads. And like, I just think we all need to reflect on the principle that started the digital marketing revolution. Mm-hmm. Nobody watches TV ads.
Yeah.
Like nobody watches them. I don't care if it's an interstitial on Hulu or Netflix. We're all annoyed by them. They aren't native. The power of Facebook and Instagram is that the ad is a part of the experience. It's no different. It's an expectation. It's an interaction that you have. We have to sort of go back to what brought us here to begin with and set aside that experience in a way that I think is like suddenly tempting again for some God knows what reason.
Interesting. Okay. So do you see part of this being like more traditional advertisers also fleeing TV as well? Or is it going to be more like, hey, smaller e-commerce brands are just going to stop and Nike will continue?
I don't speak for Tide. I think when you get into retail distribution, there's a really different strategy for supporting that kind of demand capture that it really is about my kids knowing the Progressive jingle. We are here to embed ourselves in your mind for the next 20 years. And like that form of advertising is very different than what I'm talking about. Right. I am speaking to 8-figure e-commerce brands that have to generate incremental contribution margin and free cash flow. So to be really clear, don't yell at me if you're an enterprise brand and you're like, we spend most of our money on TV. Great, keep doing it, whatever works for you. I'm talking about if you have to create a return in the next 30, 60, 90 days, that is going to degrade your actual efficiency. It just is. I see this in every spend in AMER we build. Mm-hmm. Now, I talk in absolutes because I think it's a mechanism for moving the Overton window on how we think about these things.
Sure.
Are there cases? I know the team at House is over there. You know, Olivia Corey, who I think is a really great thinker on advertising, is like, no, I've seen incremental results. Yes, you can generate success with these platforms. Just like there are stories of success being generated on YouTube and success being generated on native ads and programmatic. But the existence of an instance where there is success does not mean that for most people it will be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think about the advice we're offering is to think about what is the most likely occurrence of your dollars in television. And I think the most likely occurrence is that it degrades your contribution, not increases.
Right.
So that's the position. Not that it's not possible.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So the TV riff comes to an end, number three. So let's move on then to prediction number four. Interesting. Contribution margin shows up in Shopify Dash. Taylor, how's this going to happen?
I think that we have existed in a world where the default thing we're all taught to look at first every day is our revenue.
Mm.
And I think that is changing. I already see this, where there's this underlying movement towards everybody talking about contribution margin,
mm-hmm.
talking more about profit, talking more about gross margin. And I think that Shopify, in service of their entrepreneurs, need to help bring to the forefront these kinds of metrics. And so I think that what is going to become more normalized is being really diligent about ensuring that your cost data is a part of every product that you build, and it becomes a core piece of your data integrity to ensure that the cost side of your business is constantly considered. And I think Shopify, so this is a message to Harley and everybody else, you could help us. You could help every entrepreneur by putting into the forefront every day, not total sales. Don't lead with total sales. That's not what we're here to generate. Lead with contribution margin. Show people every day how much money they have made, not how much revenue they've captured. And I think that would be really helpful. So whether it becomes the default view, I don't know if that'll ever happen, but I think it will be a primary visible metric in the service of entrepreneurs to help them solve what we're all out here trying to do, which is grow the dollars in our pocket.
Yeah. So how about then? So for the last year or so, like the primary thing we've been talking about is we've been, I guess, sort of getting ahead of this conversation about profitability, or the shift towards profitability is like the primary goal. And with that comes all of the other sort of elements of the system that we build. To what extent do you think some of those other elements of that system are going to trickle into the general conversation and become maybe even another metric on the Shopify Dash?
Yeah, look, MER, AMER, 60-day LTV, we've been here before, right? Like we've been driving this narrative, I think, in a way that we have a pretty good record of trying to figure out what is the thing that entrepreneurs are utilizing to make their decisions. And what tends to follow is all the tools provide the information that people ask for. And so I think that we're going to see more and more of these kinds of efficiency measures. Like we're just moving from volume to efficiency. That's margin innovation is the era. And so all the messaging, all the optimization, all the possibility is going to drive people towards that measure. And the more that you can help brands create visibility into their own efficacy in producing margin, you're going to help them succeed. And that's where there's a mutual interest between Shopify and its customers, is they want them to succeed. And success now doesn't mean revenue growth. Success now means profit growth. And so Shopify should create the metrics and visibility to the metrics that help them accomplish.
Great. All right. So 2024, the year everybody finally, or AMER breaks forth, and we don't have to explain what that is anymore. But it would be nice.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Acronyms suck.
Yeah, sure. All right. So fifth and final here, and this is a prediction that will be good for my email inbox for sure, that the e-commerce SaaS bubble pops. So tell us a little bit about this, Taylor. What's going to happen here?
There's a big problem, which is that we are all fighting over the same pool of money.
Mm-hmm.
Service providers, SaaS products, platforms, payment processors, and the brands themselves, it's all one pool of money. And as these SaaS providers get bigger and bigger and bigger, the only way for them to continue to grow when the overall industry growth is not as great as the influx of competition. So if you think about like just like the total amount of e-commerce growth relative to the growth of the number of people competing for that revenue, if the supply of competition outpaces the growth of the industry, then there's a problem where the take rate has to grow. You know, and I think this is a thing that Shopify is always looking to increase their take rate. In some ways, they obviously want to grow, and a lot of their messaging is always going to be about helping, you know, more entrepreneurs succeed and growing the total market. And that's certainly part of it. But there's also consideration for the take rate. And that's the same for every SaaS platform too. You're watching Tapcart come out and say that they're going to take a percentage of revenue for the purchases that flow through their app. You know, you can watch Sean Frank blow up about this. You know, Klaviyo's pricing increases. All these platforms, the way to expand eventually is they have to get lock in and then expand their take rate. This is a pretty common tactic. The problem is we have margin pressure everywhere such that the value gets offset at some price, where the rise of what I'm calling the 80% of the features at 50% of the cost providers. Like, this is what you're seeing. It's whether it's Recart and SMS or Sendlane and email. It's just like, we're going to give you most of the things that you already have, and we're going to do it at a cheaper price. And that just happens and happens and happens till all of a sudden these things get totally commoditized or introduced and natively to the core feature set of Shopify. And I think that that pressure puts a lot of challenge onto the business model of these SaaS providers. And I think this year, more than ever, there's just a real, for whatever reason, and I don't know that it's totally fair to a lot of these. I think some of these providers do create value, but people do not want to pay for them. Yeah. And when you have influencers out in the market like Moiz Ali and Sean Frank just screaming about how they will not pay SaaS products more money, like, that is a bad state for that industry to be in when you're trying to expand and grow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I think like, yeah, I was just curious, like, to what extent a lot of the solutions that SaaS providers provide. And again, here I'm thinking through like just my experience with everything that pops into my email inbox, people trying to push this type of thing on me. It's like, how many of the functionality or how much of the functionality there is actually replicable to like a decent extent by like putting together a good Google Sheet or something like that.
That's a lot of problems.
And I think that that'll be a lot of it is that like it becomes a luxury to have this one thing be a little bit faster. Therefore, we're just going to go back to the thing that is kind of already working. And in that way, that another thing that could pop the bubble for sure.
And the other thing is that when resources become constrained, trying new things is also just a cost. It's just a time cost, right? Oh, there's the new platform Flip, or, you know, there's this new TikTok Shops. And it's like the amount of energy required to go try it is just an opportunity cost that maybe you can't afford. And so I think there's also just less trying things in this moment, you know? And so I think you combine that with this like real need that everything you do provide value. Like, this is the challenge we face as a service provider, is that fundamentally, if we don't increase the amount of money that a brand makes relative to our cost, we get fired. And that is like every app is on the chopping block under that same premise this year. Do you make me more money than you cost me? If not, you're gone. Or is there an alternative option that allows me to make an equal amount of money for less cost? And if the answer is yes, you're just gone. There's so little loyalty under the premise of anything in the software space. Like, there's just very little.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. All right. So that kind of wraps up our five predictions here. All part of, I guess, the sort of the overall prediction or overall expectation maybe that 2024 is going to be the year of margin innovation. This is the year that the need for profitability breaks free and everybody sort of understands and is already starting to understand that this is the thing that must be done for us to succeed in this upcoming year. One thing that I thought would be interesting to do is revisit our four New Year's resolutions from January of last year.
Oh boy.
And see how we remember. Did.
Oh, okay. Let's
now. See. Okay. So not too crazy here, but first is the focus on profit over growth was number one in January of last year. So that continues to be the case, but how do you think we did on that?
I think that, there were some brands that made these choices and made the decision and are now entering an era where they have the potential to grow again. And then there was also a slew of bankruptcies.
Mm-hmm.
There was also people that couldn't get there. They couldn't make the hard choices. So I think some people made the choice and they got out in front of it and they made the decision. Then some people died along the way. So I think that it was the start of the trend. It was the front end of it. And I'd say now we're more in the middle of the movement.
Yeah.
And I think that growth might actually be on the horizon here out into the future. The pendulum may swing back again someday. Mm. But for now, we're still very squarely in the profit over growth.
Interesting. Okay. Long-term, prioritizing the long-term over the short-term was resolution number two or prediction need number two. How did we do on that?
That's so funny. It was funny because literally I just put out a tweet today that says brands would be better served to focus on the short term. So I think it's funny because I think the question is, what do you mean by both statements? They're obviously a bit like pedantic and really just sort of intended to strike conversation. I think by long term in that context, what I mean is that I think that what everyone has to let go. And I got a DM from somebody the other day that basically said, I've absorbed so much of your content. And the biggest shift I've made mentally is that I'm on a 10-year journey, not a 2-year.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And what that means is that the growth rate, I think that we were all sold was like this really steep venture capital, $1 billion brand in 3 years. And we were all running as if that was the race, as if we were sprinting.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden we went, oh no, this is a marathon instead. And so that changes our behavior. Now, what it actually does is it makes your tactics more short-term, generate cash flow today, but it's because I realize I'm on a longer journey.
Yeah.
And so I think that is the sort of where these two things come together to mean the same thing in some ways, is that we've now reframed it. This is a 5-10 year growth at 10 to 20% a year, not 3-year growth at 200% a year.
Mm-hmm.
But what that leads to is the dollars I spend today generate incremental cash today that produces me the ability to survive.
Right.
And because you move into that view.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, there's no way you can't never not have short-term expectations or objectives or whatever, but the quality of those short-term expectations changes if the long-term expectations are different, is maybe part of what you're saying. That having the short-term, which maybe needs to be more focused on right now, but if that's still informed by a long-term project that actually makes more sense for the business, then the short-term objectives will inevitably be better. So resolution number three, focus on retention. That's it. Focus on retention.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember what we said in that context. I think that when you're focusing on profit, there tends to be a relationship between new customer acquisition and retention that maybe balances out because you have to focus on first order profitability and you have to take only profitable acquisition, which is going to reduce the amount of acquisition that exists and allows you to increase retention. But I don't know. I have to go back and listen and
think
about what that might be. Because I do think that again, now though, maybe the adjustment would be to think about just acquisition as being obligated to profit, which will likely reduce the amount of acquisition that occurs.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and then the final one, and I think that this is one that we can speak to more clearly because it's more personal to us, is CTC practicing what we preach. And certainly something that we struggled with in the past. How do you think we did on that this past year?
I'm learning to feel proud of of hard choices. There's a lot about the journey of the last few years that's kind of embarrassing to me that I feel like we failed. Like we, so for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, we had CTC went through some pretty hard times ourselves, where we had to go through a number of different rounds of layoffs coming out of 2022 towards the end of that year. It was a really hard year. We had come out of crazy growth. We had prioritized growth and hiring all these people and all these things and had to make the same choices that we were preaching to everybody else, which was to focus on profitability over growth. But we made those choices.
Mm-hmm.
And as hard as they were, they set up what was probably the healthiest and most stable year that we've had and puts us today in the best position we've probably ever been in. And so I'm learning to be proud of the capacity to make the hard choice that we did and go through what we went through to get to where we're at.
Awesome. Yeah. And I've definitely experienced that on my side too. And yeah, hopefully that goes into 2024 and goes for all of our listeners as well. It's like understanding that making the hard choices is going to feel bad for a long time sometimes. And that also ultimately living the present and understanding that your current situation is better than what could have otherwise been. All right. So let's talk real quick then, a final piece here on 2024, what can we expect from the e-commerce playbook podcast? So one thing, perhaps, maybe a little more excellence in broadcasting. Producer Corey says, Taylor, please stop eating ice on mic, which is what you have just heard if you're listening to the audio.
Sorry.
To the audio.
I know, I keep doing
that. You must be in a caloric deficit if that's your breakfast, but that's what I'm going for too. But anyway, yeah. So what's in store for the e-commerce playbook podcast this year? So we got, well, Taylor, why don't I let you?
Yeah. So we're going to do a bunch of stuff. One, we're moving to 2 episodes a week, which is exciting. So we're going to be publishing more. And what that's going to be is on, I think it's going to be Tuesdays we'll release. Mondays we're going to record. It's going to be Richard and I focusing on some sort of tactical conversation around the industry, et cetera, et cetera. And then on Thursdays, our regular release date, you're going to be getting an interview. And what we're going to be doing is taking a series of brands that are going to be, whether we call it GQ giants or other key successful e-commerce businesses, and we're going to be sort of looking at them through the lens of GQ score. I'm going to be doing a little intro to set up some of the dynamics about what makes the business unique. And then we're going to have an interview with one of the, either the founders or executives at those companies to tell you a little bit about what makes the brand work. We want to start to highlight some of the different unique ways in which brands are finding success in this moment. So we're looking to find profitable companies that can come on and give insight into what makes it work. And so we're going to give you more of those to sort of connect the ideas of the philosophy or methodology of GQ into the practicals of the brands that we work with. So we're going to be doing those once a week. And then at the end of every month, we're going to be doing a state of the industry report. And we've got the really exciting stuff coming out about that, where we're going to be combining with a few partners to put together what is going to be the best data set in the entire industry, where every month we're going to give you a view into how the industry is performing. It's going to be a combination of DTC CI as well as incredible benchmarks, a lot of consumer credit data. So some really cool things. They'll give you a monthly recap of some context for the environment that your business exists in.
Cool. Yeah. Lots of exciting things coming here for the e-commerce playbook universe. And we're going to continue having bonus episodes for our admission community as well, which you can hear if you join that membership as well. So for now, that's all we got. We'll see everybody again next week and happy new year.
Oh, wait, one last thing too.
Yep.
My audio sucks. Like I'm in an open room with an echo, but we share an office with Skullcandy, one of our customers, and they just built an incredible podcast studio that they're going to be using to host a bunch of creators in their space. And so we're going to be in there. And so hopefully you're going to get substantially improved audio quality from my side in terms of what's going on, better visuals, more clips, a lot of stuff coming. So excited to have you all on this journey. One thing, we don't ask a lot for you to rate, review, et cetera, but it does make a huge difference. If there's an episode that you love, leave a comment, go into the Apple Podcast app or Spotify. If you could save us or bookmark or subscribe, those things mean a ton. So we appreciate all of you and we're excited to really ramp it up this year and make this a valuable tool in your tool belt.
Cool, folks. Alrighty, lots of exciting things coming into the e-commerce playbook universe. We will see you all next week. Take care.